They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Underestimated Brandy Peltz. Except today, we aren't going to be discussing Brandy. Instead, today's episode will be telling the story of Darlene Hulse. When discussing Brandy's case, Darlene often becomes a point of discussion because she went missing from a similar area a couple of years prior. We briefly talked about her situation in our first episode, but we'll go in much more depth during this episode. Darlene was a 28-year-old mother from rural Marshall County, Indiana, whose life was stolen in 1984. Her case has remained unsolved for decades, and what makes it so haunting is not only the violence of what happened, but how ordinarily the day began. On August 17, 1984, Darlene was at home in Argus, a small community in Marshall County, Indiana, with her three daughters, aged 6 and 8 years old and 11 months old. The older daughters were taking a bath while Darlene was caring for the infant. Everything was normal until there was a loud knock at the front door. Marie, the 8-year-old daughter, had heard the strange noises that ensued and ran to go check on her mother. She expected a surprise, something happy like a puppy. But to her horror, what she saw was her mother, on the floor with a strange man on top of her. Investigators believe he used a delivery-style ruse or disguise to get her to open the door, then forced his way inside and attacked Darlene. He was trying to put duct tape on her mouth, but she was desperately fighting for the sake of her life and her children. Marie says she heard her mother screaming and saw her scraping at his face, which caused her to scream and go running to the phone in the kitchen. The intruder saw this and went running after her, dragging Darlene by the hair behind him. Darlene screamed for her child to run, and she did. Frantically, Marie went to alert her 6-year-old sister, Melissa, before running back to the kitchen and out the back door. She ran as fast as she could, as fast as her little legs would carry her. The girls ran past a strange car in their driveway, a dirty, rusty, teal-green Cutlass on the way to their grandparents' house down the street. Frantically, she begged her grandmother to call the police, trying in all her panic to get help for her mother. It was during the call that Melissa caught up, and both of the older siblings were safely at their grandparents' house. Unfortunately, the same could not be said for the infant Kristen and Darlene. When officers arrived at the Hulse home, they were under the impression that this was an armed robbery. However, as they approached the house, they noticed a trail of blood leading from the driveway into the house. Inside, baby Kristen was found crying, covered in blood. Her mother? Nowhere to be seen. No way to find her, save for the long smears of blood and evidence of a struggle. Investigators found remnants of duct tape, a tennis shoe, and Darlene's smock, which had been ripped off. In the kitchen, the remnants of a phone cord pulled out of the receiver were found alongside fireplace tools that were scattered on the floor near the stove. They found all of the tools, save for a part of the fireplace poker that was missing. This detail led officers to assume that that's what the killer had attacked Darlene with. An improvised weapon, the perpetrator wasn't prepared to kill when he broke into the Hulse residence. Crime scene technicians found all of this, but meanwhile, there was a manhunt out looking for Darlene. It felt like the entire town of Argus was looking for her, which makes it all the more ironic that a visitor from North Manchester stumbled upon her instead. It was complete happenstance. A man named Walter was interested in buying land in Argus, a lumberman who wanted the acreage for its timber. On this day, he came to survey the woods one last time before he made his decision. He was slowly driving by, looking for a good way in, when he came upon a spot where the fence had been partially cut. He hopped over it, passed through approximately 70 feet of brush, and it was then that he saw Darlene. He flagged down a passing farmer on a tractor, and together they went to call the authorities. The police followed the drag marks from the fence into the woods and found her body. posed, lying on her back with one arm on her side and her other arm over her head. Her clothes were disheveled, unnaturally pushed up or down to nearly expose her. For something like a baggy sweater and a skirt that reaches the knee, that is purposeful. Cuts and bruises marred her skin, all over her arms, legs, and torso, in addition to the blood from the aforementioned blunt force trauma all over her head. These wounds suggest a vicious and likely sexually motivated crime, which befits the way the perpetrator acted at the scene. No money or valuables were missing from the house, even funds that were readily available and in plain sight. Perhaps the killer's original plan was abandoned once the young children escaped, or perhaps he had sexual motives from the very beginning. The question is, did he choose Darlene on purpose? Did he stake out the house knowing she would be home when he used his ruse? The brutal, bloody state of the body and crime scene also suggests a lot of anger was present in the killer. Maybe he knew Darlene in some capacity, or maybe her fighting caused him to use her as an outlet for his rage. Overall, there are a lot of things that are unclear in this case, and that is part of the reason why her killer has not yet been found. Our most substantial piece of information comes from Darlene's daughter, who describes the killer as she saw him when she ran out that day. In an interview with the two daughters from the Deck Investigates podcast, Marie describes him as a tall white man in his late 20s, with combed over blonde hair that was sort of two-toned. He wore a dark tan shirt with stripes, a tan pair of pants with no belt, and brown leather shoes. Police reports state that his build would be around 6'2 and 145 to 150 pounds. Using the information that we've established, investigators from both the past and present have tracked down many different suspects, the details of which we'd like to share and compare to Brandy's circumstances.
At the beginning of the case, there were four main suspects. They were Daniel Binder, a man from Colorado that allegedly called the police with information, Robert Zabrowski, a carnival worker that was in the area around the time, Richard Mock, an infamous robber that robbed people mainly in Indiana and Illinois, and Ron Hulse, the husband of Darlene. The following will be explaining who these people were and why they were deemed a suspect. Some people believed that the father, Ron Hulse, may have had something to do with it. In an interview with the Indianapolis Star, he said it was God's will that Darlene was taken, which made people suspicious because of how accepting he was of Darlene's murder. He also remarried the following year. The next suspect is Daniel Binder, a 22-year-old man from Colorado. According to the Tribune on September 1st, he was extradited and held on a 72-hour warrant. The police thought he would have information related to the crime because of a call Binder made to the police claiming he had information, so he was brought to Marshall County. When in custody of the police, he was given a polygraph test in which he failed, and prosecutor Fred Jones believed that Binder might have information. He was accused of helping the criminal but pleaded innocence on September 6th. Robert Zabrowski was a carnival worker that traveled around the area at the time of the incident. He was a drifter and moved from place to place and was staying in Plymouth when Darlene was killed. Shortly after the murder, he left the area to continue his carnival work. The police brought him back to conduct investigations against him, such as taking fingerprint, blood, and saliva samples. Robert was very cooperative, and he was determined to no longer be a suspect after questioning. The final suspect was Richard, Ricky, Mock from Texas. He was a known thief around Indiana and Illinois. He allegedly stole items from every house and every street. He and his car looked similar to the description given by Marine. According to the Logansport Tribune, he was a suspect in many armed robberies that happened in many cities surrounding Logansport, including Frankfort, Norman, West Lafayette, and more. He was also suspected in robberies that took place around the Holtz home. Later, he committed suicide by cop back in Texas. The police conducted blood tests, which didn't exclude him from being a suspect, but it wasn't a full confirmation. Argus was a very small town with at most 1,000 citizens living there, so theoretically, it should be easy figuring out who did it. People most likely didn't want to get involved with the case, or they didn't want to ruin the life of the attacker. Kristen grew up thinking it was Mock, the infamous robber from around Indiana and Illinois, but after she found out it wasn't him, she had to do more research. She believes this wasn't a first-time offense, so she looked at similar cases that happened around the area. Cold Case Chronicles also interviewed Mr. Nelson, an investigator. He also believes it was sexually motivated. The intruder got the sexual gratification from breaking in and raping someone, but got thwarted by them fighting back, causing him to react in the moment. It was the attacker's plan to rape them. That's why the kids weren't harmed. It was all about the mom. He didn't enter the home with a weapon. He never expected them to fight back. Mr. Nelson said the only way this can be solved is by Mal. Someone will have to speak up about what they know, as any information is necessary to solve Darlene Hulse's case. People that believe Ron had something to do with it point out the dog not being home the day of the murder, as it was at the breeder. People say that the dog would have never let Darlene get attacked. He could have set up the day at the right time so someone could break in. Later, ads in the newspaper began appearing detailing dogs that were for sale by Ron, disproving what people have been saying in relation to the dog. According to Detective David, Daniel Binder never contacted the police first. An anonymous tip was sent because Daniel Binder looked similar to the description of the attacker. Against what the newspapers were saying, no polygraph test or trial was conducted in response to the tip. He was cleared based on simple questioning. Robert Zabrowski also fit the description of the murderer. Similarly to Binder, he became a suspect after an anonymous tip. Since he was a carnivore worker, he was able to leave the town quickly after the murder. They did a quick questioning in which Robert was very cooperative and determined he was no longer a suspect. Richard Mock became a suspect because of the nature of his crime and Darlene Hulse's case. He was eventually ruled out after the police determined Hulse's case to more likely be sexually motivated. He was eventually ruled out after the police determined Hulse's case to more likely be sexually motivated rather than a robbery, though some still think the attacker stole some items. After he died, detectives decided not to look into him anymore. Even though the first four suspects have been ruled out, two new ones have been brought up. 2 years after the murder of Darlene Hulse, a man named Kenneth McCoon broke into a woman's house in an attempt to rape her in Argus, Indiana. He was 25 at the time of Darlene's murder, fitting the age range theorized for the attacker. He was sentenced to 10 years after getting caught in December of 1988. His family owned an automotive service, which gave him access to many vehicles. Many people suspect he could have killed Darlene because the nature of the crimes are very similar, especially with the theories of Darlene's case being sexually motivated. Just a day after Darlene's murder, Reverend Ray Obiett commented under the Indianapolis Star saying, "It's a very difficult thing. None of us expected something like this. We're very trusting." He worshipped at the same church Darlene and her husband went to. At some point, Reverend Obiett stopped going to the church. After the murder, a rumor spread around of Darlene going to the church on an abnormal day, most likely for piano lessons. At the church, the rumor states she caught Reverend Ray Obiett molesting a child. Her death could be related as an act to make her shut up about it, although the attacker never entered the home with a weapon besides duct tape, as stated by Kristen in an interview conducted by Cold Case Chronicles. Obiett was originally from Pennsylvania, and there he did a lot of events related to the Boy Scouts and was sentenced to 6 years in prison for molesting a child in 1986. Another rumor states that Obiett had a similar vehicle to the one at the crime scene, and he had more cars that he claimed were broken.
When beginning to research Brandy's circumstances, Darlene's tragedy often enters the conversation as a possible connection. It isn't strange that people would try to consider a connection between the two. Both crimes are unsolved cases and have remained that way for 40 years. So much so that they continue to haunt the community. These losses are like open wounds, unresolved pain that people cannot ignore. Brandy was killed in 1986 and Darlene in 1984. Close enough to be considered a pattern by the rural town of Argus. Though it's possible that they just found solace in thinking that there was only one murderous criminal running around Marshall County. In both cases, the victims were attacked with improvised weapons that were found broken at the scene. Furthermore, the victims were attacked in their home while going about their day. but the crime scenes themselves differ in a very meaningful way. Brandy was found strangled and sexually assaulted with her home on fire, meaning the killer's concern while concealment or staging of some sort. In contrast, Darlene's case was very mobile. She was brutally beaten, taken from her home, presumably sexually assaulted, and left in the woods. Despite the secluded area may suggest, no real efforts were taken to conceal her body. The perpetrator could have covered her in leaves, branches, or more of the surrounding greenery, but instead they just left her there, cold and distant. In addition, the victimology differs wildly. Brandy's killer cornered a weak and vulnerable 11-year-old when she was alone, while Darlene's killer was prepared to confront an adult in front of witnesses, while taking the risk of moving the victim elsewhere. The difference in treatment and mindset paints two very different pictures, to the point where it gets difficult to consider the two similar. In the first episode, we talked about how personal Brandy's case felt. Someone staked out her house, watching her every move, learning her family's routine enough to weaponize it against her. While in Darlene's case, someone acted very sloppily, taking action while the kids were present and then allowing them to escape. It's a good thing that the girls were alright, of course, but it does contrast starkly with Brandy, whose murder shows a lot more preparation and deliberate action. If the killer were the same, their pattern would be to do some level of reconnaissance, so they wouldn't know to plan for Darlene's daughters. This is further supported by the harassing phone calls, which were only received by Brandy and her family. Too many details don't match up, despite the various rumors that tried to propose the idea of a serial killer in the Marshall County area. People had to compare them because they're close in geography and time, and this was a route that we considered very early on, but any other resemblances are rather tenuous. Back then, investigators and commentators also wondered about the connection, but the differences are more abundant than any similarities. In accordance with this, law enforcement offices treated the two cases as separate instances with separate killers, with one investigative transcript outright saying that they were considered unrelated. We generally agree with that statement, and, in our opinion, the difference in offender behavior is too great to propose that the cases are linked.
This is just a general overview of Darlene's case for the purpose of comparing her to Brandy over the course of a single episode. If you're interested in hearing more, listen to Season 1 of the Deck Investigates podcast, where they discuss Darlene's circumstances in depth over the course of 18 episodes. Finally, though this lead has fizzled out, we have one more investigative avenue left to explore. In our final episode, we are going to continue our coverage of Brandy's case by exploring a possible connection to Linda Weldy. That's next week on Underestimated Brandy Peltz. Thank you for listening. Underestimated Brandy Peltz was researched, written, and produced by Gracie, Lexi, and Jacob. Intro music by Haley, all other music by Shane Yoder. Our show artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was created by Jacob. The Underestimated podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community School's Broadcasting CTE program. We want to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping to fund our work. Please make sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcast player, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.